about cosmic strings from supersymmetric flat directions. I'll tell you a bit more about what these things are in a minute. And this is based on some recent work with some people at Michigan and elsewhere, namely Yano Tsui, who's a very good student at Michigan, as well as Steve Martin and James Wells. Okay, so let me start off by giving you the basic ingredients. And the basic ingredients are just cosmic strings and supersymmetry. Okay, so even before talking about cosmic strings or supersymmetry, let me back up and just mention that when we try to combine special relativity with quantum mechanics, what we're led to typically is something called quantum field theory, which is just quantum mechanics applied to a continuous system. And what happens when we quantize a field is that we find quantum excitations that look like particles. So the picture in quantum field theory is that for a given field, there are particle excitations. In addition to particle excitations, in quantum field theories, there also exist field configurations that don't have an obvious particle interpretation, but are still interesting. And cosmic strings are an example of this. They're a special kind of field configuration in field theories involving scalar fields. And at least the reason why I'm interested in them is that cosmic strings can be formed in the early universe, and they have some interesting signatures. For instance, they can seed large-scale structure formation. They can generate gravitational lensing. They can produce gravity waves. And let me also mention in passing that cosmic strings can also emerge from superstring theory. And I'll refer to these superstring cosmic strings as cosmic superstrings. I won't have too much to say about them, but I'll mention them as I go along. So let me start off with cosmic strings, and let me start off by giving you a simple example. And this simple example is just a theory with a complex scalar field phi. And we define our scalar field theory with the following Lagrangian. There's just a kinetic term and a simple potential. And what you probably already noticed is that this theory has a symmetry. This theory has a U1 symmetry under which I rephase my scalar field phi. And it's easy to check that the Lagrangian is invariant. Now, even though my underlying theory is U1 symmetric, it turns out that the vacuum state is not. By looking at the potential, it's not hard to see that at the minimum of the potential, the value of my scalar field is non-zero. And because the value of the scalar field at the minimum has to take on a particular value, this vacuum value is no longer invariant under the U1 symmetries. And therefore, the U1 symmetry is broken by this vacuum expectation value. And the jargon for this is just spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, within the context of a U1 scalar field theory, the spontaneous symmetry breaking, you can find cosmic strings. So now, in this case, within this theory, a cosmic string is just a special axially symmetric field configuration. So here's an example. My scalar field phi is axially symmetric, where these are axial coordinates. My field configuration is independent of z. As the angular dependence, the axial dependence is just that my scalar field wraps around some integer number of times. And then there's some radial profile that I describe by this function f of r. Now, as f of r goes to infinity, I'm going to assume that it goes to unity as r goes to infinity, and my f of r goes to 0 as r goes to 0. Now, it turns out that with these boundary conditions and with this field configuration, the configuration has a finite energy as long as this function f of r is nice. And for the experts, I also have to put in a gauge field. But I'm going to suppress that for most of the talk. And what we call this field configuration is just a cosmic string with winding number n. And n, again, is just the number of times this integer. It's just the number of times the field winds as I go off to spatial infinity. Okay, now this cosmic string configuration isn't the lowest energy state in theory. The lowest energy state in the theory just has my scalar field phi being constant everywhere. However, my cosmic string configuration turns out to be stable, even though it doesn't have a minimal energy. And the reason for this is topology. Because the field has to be single-valued, it has to wrap an integer number of times as you go off to spatial infinity. Now, it turns out that to go from a state with a given winding number at infinity to a state with a different winding number at infinity, there's an infinite energy cost. And because of this infinite energy cost, my cosmic strings are stable. Now, in general, the properties of the cosmic string are set by the value of the vacuum expectation value of my scalar field. So I call this thing V. And the typical width of the string is roughly 1 over V. The tension of the string, which is just the energy of the string per unit string length, is on the order of V squared. And I should mention that I'm here, and throughout my talk, I'm using natural units with H bar equals C equals KB equals 1. And therefore, length just corresponds to an inverse mass scale, and so on.
There is a web of the field, and there is a Higgs mass. Are you taking them both the same?
I'm taking them both the same. In this case, for a non-supersymmetric field, I'll get to this in a second, but for a non-supersymmetric theory, the point is that these two things are naturally the same size. I'll come back to this. Okay, I should also mention that for the simple example I presented, the only cosmic string state that is typically stable is the lowest winding number, the n equals 1 state. And these properties are typical of what I call ordinary cosmic strings. Now, cosmic strings can be formed in the Euler universe. And the way they're formed in the Euler universe is in the phase transition. And the picture of the phase transition is that if I look at the quantum fraction split potential in a thermal bath, I pick up terms that are proportional to the temperature squared. So this T is the temperature. And if I look at my potential now, as long as the temperature is much, much larger than the scale is V, which is the zero temperature expectation value, the minimum of my potential now lies at the origin of the field space. And when the minimum is at the origin of the field space, my U1 symmetry is unbroken. However, as I go from a high temperature state to a low temperature state, what I find is that eventually this piece becomes subdominant to the minus V squared piece. The scalar field phi picks up an expectation value, and the symmetry is broken. And this is just the phase transition. OK, so I'll come back to cosmic strings in a minute, but I just wanted to digress and mention supersymmetry. Fortunately, there's some nice talks yesterday motivating supersymmetry, so I won't go into why supersymmetry is interesting. Let me just say that it's an extension of the Poincaré symmetries of flat spacetime, or at least global supersymmetry is. And what supersymmetry does is it relates particles of a given spin to particles of a spin differing by half a unit. In other words, it relates bosons to fermions. And the very nice thing about supersymmetry is that a lot of the dangerous quantum corrections that arise in non-supersymmetric field theories end up canceling out. And because of this, supersymmetry is a natural setting for scalar fields. And as I just showed you, scalar fields are an essential ingredient to cosmic strings. It also turns out that a very common feature in supersymmetric field theories are directions in the scalar potential that are extremely flat. Again, this is because of the cancellations you get because of supersymmetry. And what I'll talk about for the rest of my talk is the cosmic strings associated with symmetry breaking along a supersymmetric flat direction, and what these strings look like, and how you might hope to see them with various cosmological probes. OK, so let me start off with the properties of flat direction strings. So Maxime, I think this will address your question. Here is a sample effective potential characterizing a flat direction. And now this potential has two mass scales. The first mass scale I call little m, and the second mass scale I call big M. And I'm going to assume that little m is much, much smaller than big M. And in my potential, what I see is the little m piece destabilizes the origin. Now, I should also mention that this potential is U1 symmetric. But the little m piece pushes the field away from the origin, and this induces symmetry, spontaneous symmetry breaking. On the other hand, the second piece that's suppressed by a 1 over m with m large ends up stabilizing the field value way out at large values. And the form of this potential, oh, yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you in the sentence there, but I know nothing about supersymmetry, and I don't understand what flat direction effective potential means. Can you explain that? Flat direction, what?
I'll tell you what I mean by flat in a second. But roughly, as a working definition, you can think of, when I say flat direction, think of this potential. I just use that as a word.
Is that just a regular scalar field, or is there something supersymmetric in there already?
As I've written it, there's nothing particularly supersymmetric.
Okay.
The reason why supersymmetry is important is that normally, if I was to write down a potential like this with a small mass scale and a big mass scale, there'd be big quantum corrections, and those big quantum corrections would take my small mass scale and would push it up to the scale of the big mass scale.
Oh, really?
So supersymmetry comes in as important because with supersymmetry, you get these almost magical cancellations. And with these very special cancellations, you don't destabilize this form. You're able to keep this hierarchy of scale. You're able to keep this small m way smaller than this big m in a natural way. So this is really where supersymmetry comes in. But you're right. Roughly, this is about all supersymmetry I'm going to use for most of the talk. But a good question. Thank you.
So that's the whole point in solving the hierarchy problem, right?
It's also related to the hierarchy problem.
So that's why people talk about using SUSY to help the hierarchy problem. How can any mass be less than the best scale or whatever?
OK, right. So we're not necessarily looking at that same sector. We have in mind some new sector. But in any case, the same cancellations implied by supersymmetry allow the potential to be flat in the sense.
So you have standard scalar field, but supersymmetry allows you to keep that restriction or limit as big as
exactly. Mass. Exactly.
That's all you're doing.
Right. And that's basically all you need to know about supersymmetry for this talk.
Sounds good. I can do that.
OK. I should also mention that supersymmetry also prevents the generation of terms with n equals 0. Again, the same thing. But in any case, when I take this potential, and if I use this this hierarchy of scales, what I find is that the vacuum value of the scalar field phi is on the order of this expression. And if you look at this expression with m much smaller than m, you'll see that the expectation value is much, much larger than the small mass scale. And this is what I mean about the flatness of the potential. If I draw the potential, it turns out that the scale of the curvature of the potential is set by this little m. So the curvature around here and around the minimum is set by little m. But the scale of this curvature is way, way smaller than the scale of this VEV. So the VEV, in some sense, is really far out. And to go from the origin to the VEV, it's very, very flat. And by flat, I just mean curvature much smaller, much, much smaller than VEV scale. OK, so with this potential, again, we have a U1 symmetry. It's spontaneously broken. And we can look for cosmic string solutions. Again, we look for solutions of the same form I mentioned before. There's some integer number of windings at infinity. There's some radial profile, f of r. And as I go off to radial infinity, my field picks up a vacuum expectation value. So my potential is essentially minimized. And what we did is we took roughly this ansatz. We looked for approximate solutions to the equations of motion of the form of this ansatz. And then to refine it, we used this approximate solution of the equations of motion to do a variational estimate of the string energy per unit length. And the stable cosmic string configuration should correspond to the variational minimum given this ansatz. And what we find, the only piece to really solve for is this profile function f of r. And what we find is a profile function that looks something like this. It goes from 0 to 1, going to infinity. And the most interesting feature that I'd like to point out is that the width of this profile, the distance over which it goes from 0 to 1, is on the order of m inverse. So
three sections, right?
It actually does. Yeah, there's actually, I'm actually suppressing a lot of stuff. We actually have gauge fields floating around, and it turns out that there's a gauge field profile, and that gauge field profile is actually of size V inverse. So yeah, so there actually is a little bit of structure here, and this little bit of structure here is actually size V inverse. But the total size of the string is M inverse. So what we end up with is cosmic strings that are very wide. They're much wider than the scale that sets the symmetry breaking scale. And this is sort of the raison d'etre of the cosmic strings. They're very wide, and if you compare this to what I call ordinary cosmic strings, roughly the cosmic strings you'd expect in a generic non-supersymmetric theory, you see that these flat direction strings are much, much wider, again, by this hierarchy of scales. Because remember, this little m scale is much, much smaller than the vacuum expectation value scale. And this is just the property of flatness of the potential. Okay, so another thing we can look at is the tension of the cosmic strings. Now, what I mean by tension is just the energy of the cosmic string configuration per unit length. And what we find is that the tension of these strings is set by the scale of the vacuum expectation value. So the energy per unit length is on the order of V squared. And this is like for ordinary cosmic strings. So maybe this isn't so surprising. But the twist for these flat direction strings is that if we look at the tensions of the higher winding modes, of modes that wind more than once as you go up to spatial infinity, modes that wind two or three or four times or a lot more, what we find is the tension increases really, really slowly with this winding number. So here I have a plot of the tension as a function of the winding number for a certain set of input parameters. And roughly going from winding number one to winding number 100, I go from something like 0.1 to about 0.13. Yes? Yeah, the tension of a string is just its energy per unit length. Okay, but in any case, it turns out that we can fit this curve roughly with a log. The tension of the nth mode is roughly the tension of the first mode with a log correction. And it's a log correction with a small prefactor. Because remember, V is much, much bigger than M. And this is a fairly small number. And well, the upshot of all this is that these higher winding modes, if I look at the tension of a winding mode with winding N plus M, the tension of this mode is a lot less than the tension of the sum of the tensions of an N mode with an M mode. It's actually the higher winding mode stuff wasn't. So yes, there has been previous work, probably more like 10 years ago. But you had a paper beside you. But most of the work focused on I think you're looking at flat potentials for inflation. But anyways, most of the work focused on the n equals one mode, and not much had been done on the higher modes. But the upshot of this is that if I take a string with winding n and a string with winding m, if I smunch them together, I get a mode with winding number n plus m, and this combined winding mode has a lower tension and should be stable. And this is going to turn out to be important for the phenomenology. Okay, so before I get to the phenomenology, let me tell you about how cosmic strings interact with each other. For ordinary cosmic strings, there are basically two possibilities. The first possibility is that when these cosmic strings come together, they just pass right through each other. The second possibility is that they do something called intercommute, or reconnect. And the picture for intercommuting, or reconnecting, is just that I take two cosmic strings that are coming towards each other, and these two cosmic strings, when they meet each other, exchange ends. So they come together like this, and exchange ends on the hockey stick. They come together, they exchange ends, and they go up. Am I making sense? Maybe I should show you my cartoon. This is a string coming in, this is a string coming out. They hit each other, they exchange partners, and they reconnect as two cosmic strings like this. Yes.
That So that's not a minus sign there in the middle? These aren't on my campus.
Oh, no, sorry. This should be a little arrow here.
Oh, okay.
Well, it didn't come out. Sorry, it should be time. So this is the initial state, and this is the final state. So the strings exchange partners, and I tried to show this my cartoon with color coding. I didn't know enough programming to do an animation, which would be better. But. Okay, and I should also say that flag strings can also contribute. The general lore on ordinary cosmic strings is that when two of these strings hit each other, they almost always intercommute. They rarely pass through each other. The probability for them to intercommute is about one. And it turns out that the story for flat strings is going to be a little different. For flat strings, remember that the tension of higher modes increases very slowly with the winding number. And because it increases very slowly with the winding number, higher winding mode states are stable. And the upshot of this is that there's a new interaction mode as a result. Now, when I have two strings coming together, these strings can sort of glomp together where they're intersecting. And they glomp together, and they form a mode with a higher winding number. So in this cartoon, and again, this is supposed to be an arrow pointing forward in time. This is my initial state with two n equals 1 strings coming together, where n is the winding number. And these strings come together. And when they intersect, near the intersection point, they glomp together, because this is energetically favorable. And they form a bridge of n equals 2 string. And since this n equals 2 string is energetically favored over having two n equals 1 strings, this bridge grows. It sort of zips along, and it zips up these two n equals 1 strings. So not surprisingly, we call this zippering. And it can also happen for higher winding modes. So instead of having n equals 1 meeting n equals 1, more generally, you can have modes with winding numbers n plus m. And it turns out that topologically, you can go to modes with n plus m or n minus m. Yes?
You don't mind another silly question from a non-expert. Before, you had some sort of radially symmetric solution. Is that right? So should I think of these strings as sort of like donuts or closed strings coming together? I mean, is that
think of them as infinitely long, essentially. Or by infinite, I mean horizon length.
But is it some sort of, can I think of it as a one-dimensional object, like some sort of string, like actually moving through space?
Yes, or is it something? Okay. You can think of it as, unless you get very close to it, in which case you can resolve its finite width. But as you get far away from it, it just looks like a string.
Okay, so these things are huge.
Yes.
And they're propagating through space, and they're fluttering around, whatever. So that actually, so your one-dimensional line there should really be some sort of two-dimensional world sheet for the string that's coming together? Or because if one axis is time, it's like you have two particles coming together. So what?
Sorry. I don't have time going up or going sideways. This is the initial state. This is the final state, and it's a space diagram. It's not space time.
Okay. So
maybe
you have a string. It's extended in space. There's another one. It's extended in space.
Exactly.
It does something. In the
exactly. It's not a space time diagram. It's just a space diagram.
Sorry.
No. It's a good question.
Okay. That makes sense.
I have a question too.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I'm not an expert too, but you can't decompose these. So the local interaction region there has degree 3, right? There's 3 things sticking out of that little vertex there.
Yes.
On the right hand side locally.
Yeah.
You can't decompose something like that into in the basis of things with degree 2 or 4. Like, I guess what I'm wondering is, why does it have, I don't know, that seems to do something strange to my notion of what it should be doing. And I can't really explain it better than that. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, can you decompose that in another basis so that it looks like some superposition of, not that configuration, but other configurations with degree 4, degree 2, or, you know, with just degree 4 interactions?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
If you start zooming into the interaction region, it's a very complicated nonlinear field configuration.
Okay.
And most of this stuff is just done in a Nemugoto approximation, where you ignore the internal structure.
Okay.
But there might be something doable on those lines.
Okay.
Okay. In any case, flat cosmic strings zipper in this way. And it turns out that zippering isn't always possible.
there are kinematic constraints on it. And, well, one simple kinematic constraint is that the tension of the n equals 2 string has to be less than twice the tension of an n equals 1 string. And this should be obvious. As the zip ring occurs, I lose n equals 1, I lose essentially 2 units of n equals 1 string to produce 1 unit of n equals 2 string. So energetically, I have to have the tension of the 2 string to be less than twice the tension of a 1 string. But it also turns out that if you compute the kinematics of it, just in another little approximation, there are also kinematic constraints on this. So for instance, what I plot here is the allowed region for zippering for two different ratios of mu2 over mu1. And the allowed region lies in these interior regions. This alpha is the initial relative angle between the two strings. So this alpha is just this alpha, the relative angle of the incoming strings. And the v is just the relative initial velocity. So you can see that for very large initial velocities, you don't get zippering. Zippering is not kinematically allowed. And for very large relative angles, zippering is also not kinematically allowed. But as long as the relative angle isn't too big, or the initial velocity isn't too big, you can have zippering. Now, the special thing about flat strings is that this ratio of mu2 over mu1 is pretty close to 1. So there's a lot of area for which zippering can occur. On the other hand, if I look at something that's more typical of an ordinary cosmic string, where I have mu2 over mu1 pretty close to 2, I can only zipper in this little region. Now, I'll get to this in a minute, but typically, a standard velocity for a cosmic string in the early universe is on the order of, say, 0.6 in units of speed of light. So the upshot of this is, if I draw my 0.6 line, if I have two flat strings intersecting in the early universe, there's a pretty good chance they're going to zipper. On the other hand, if I have ordinary strings with a pretty large value of mu2 over mu1, I only have a small region, and it's unlikely that zippering will occur for them. So qualitatively, flat direction strings interact differently in the early universe. And okay, I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. Let me just give you a brief intermediate summary. Ordinary strings have a string tension set by the symmetry breaking scale. And the same scale also sets the width of the string. And typically, zippering is unlikely. On the other hand, for flat strings, they're very wide. But they still have a tension that's about the same size as for ordinary strings. But their higher winding modes are very stable. And zippering is often possible. And let me also mention in passing that cosmic superstrings, I mentioned this in the introduction, and these are just cosmic strings from superstring theory, are also able to zipper. So flat direction strings are, in some sense, a field theory analog of these cosmic superstrings. OK, so let me get on to cosmology in the time I have left. You heard some cosmology yesterday. But roughly, the only thing you need to keep in mind is the universe is expanding. And we describe this expansion with a function a of t called the scale factor. And this scale factor is monotonically increasing. And this scale factor is roughly describes how quickly things are separating. Now, as things separate, the temperature comes down. So for much of the evolution of the universe, the temperature is inversely proportional to the scale factor. And as the universe expands, things dilute and the universe cools. Now, if I look at non-interacting cosmic strings, what I find is that the energy density of these non-interacting cosmic strings scales as a to the minus 2. And this looks like a problem, because if I look at something like matter, or if I look at radiation, both matter and radiation dilute more quickly as the universe expands than my non-interacting strings. And this could be a problem because, well, if I run forward long enough in time, I expect my cosmic strings to come to dominate the energy density of the universe. But since we don't see strings, this would seem to be inconsistent with what we observe. It turns out that there's a way out. And the way out is, because of this intercommutation process I told you about, cosmic strings can form loops. And loops aren't topologically stable, and they can decay away. And the upshot of this is that when you add string interactions into the evolution of the string network, what you find is that the energy density in the cosmic string network tracks the background energy density of matter or radiation. And roughly, that is to say, the energy density of the strings
is some small number. This g mu, I'll come back to it in a minute, but this g mu is a small dimensionless constant times the energy density of the background stuff, matter and radiation. And this behavior is called cosmic string scaling. OK, so now for flat strings, what I just told you was for ordinary strings. For flat strings, you also have the zip ring interaction. And so now, instead of just forming loops by intercommutating, you can also zipper. And therefore, you expect that in your string network, instead of just having one kind of string, you have lots of different kinds of strings. And what we did is we used a simple evolution model by Ty Wyman and Wasserman to model this evolution of a multi-tension string network. And what we find is that flat direction strings also seem to have the scaling property, where they track the background energy density of matter or radiation. And in this plot, I show the ratio of the energy density of the nth string mode, the nth winding mode, relative to the critical density as a function of time. And in our simulation, we start with only n equals 1 strings. And the higher winding modes are generated dynamically. So what we see is we start with some very large density of n equals 1 string. And then it quickly equilibrates. And as it's equilibrating, we also form higher winding mode strings. So here I have n equals 2, 3, 4, 5. And eventually, these strings all flow towards the same value. And they flow towards the same value that tracks the background energy density. So in this region, radiation is dominant. And the string density is some small fraction of the radiation density. And then in this region, matter is dominant. And the string density then tracks the matter density. OK, what we also find is the density of each string species is roughly inversely proportional to the number of total strings that have equilibrated in the string network. And because of this property, the total energy density within the string network is spread out fairly uniformly among the different string species in the network. This is just a plot of the energy density of a given string mode relative to the critical density as a function of the total number of strings we put in our simulation. And roughly, a pretty good fit is obtained with this 1 over n relation. So for our flat strings, the picture is that instead of just having one kind of string tracking the background energy density, we have a whole lot of different kinds of strings, all with pretty similar tensions, pretty similar properties, and pretty similar densities that together have a total density equal to the density of a single string that doesn't form zippers. But in any case, the fact that we have scaling is very important because it means that the cosmological consequences of these strings are relatively benign. So that's my next topic. The neat thing about cosmic strings is they're not too dangerous because of the scaling property, but they also have lots of different interesting signatures. Generally, these interesting signatures can be characterized by a single number. And the single number is just what I call g mu. G is Newton's constant. Mu is a string tension. And this is dimensionless. And its parametric size is the size of the symmetry breaking scale divided by the Planck mass. And you square the whole thing. Now, there are different kinds of string signatures. From very long strings, and by long, I mean horizon sized, these long strings produce wakes as they propagate along. And in these wakes, these wakes can be a source of large-scale structure formation. Now, given the shape of the CMB distribution, we don't seem to see these wakes. And this puts a limit on this dimensionless constant g mu to be less than about 10 to the minus 7. So you think of this as an upper bound on the symmetry breaking scale. Another interesting thing that cosmic strings do is when light goes by them, since they're very dense, they have a lot of energy density in them, they bend light. And this is gravitational lensing. And there's a very nice double lensing effect. On top of the long strings, you also have string loops. And these loops aren't topologically stable. And what they do, well, they tend to oscillate. And as they oscillate, again, they have a lot of matter density oscillating away, they give off gravity waves. And eventually decay away. And limits from, let's say, millisecond pulsar timing put bounds on this dimensionless constant to be less than roughly 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 10. It depends a bit on the details, but a little bit stronger than the structure measurements. Let me also mention in passing that I've managed to work in strings and loops into a single talk. It's just not regular. The gravity waves interfere, and the timing signal is just—it's not as regular as what's seen.
Use the strings around these results?
The gravity wave property.
Oh, there's a background.
There's a background gravity wave, and then it jiggles the signal. Okay, so most of this stuff was just for ordinary strings. For flat strings, there's again more to the story. One common thing for all kinds of strings is that they can form cusps. And all that a cusp is if I think of my loop oscillating, a cusp is a region where it goes like, well, I've drawn it here, but where you sort of form a point very quickly. And this point is called a cusp. It might seem a bit surprising, but these cusps seem to be fairly generic features of oscillating string loops. Typically, they seem to occur about once per oscillation period. And each time a cusp occurs, a small amount of string is annihilated. Yes?
I know what a cusp looks like, and I'm not getting anything more from that diagram than that. Can you tell me, what are the axes? What are you plotting?
I'm not actually plotting anything. It's just a cartoon.
Tell you what a cusp is?
Sorry?
Just to tell me what the cusp looks like?
Yes.
Okay, so what does it actually do? What does it mean in your theory then? String loops frequently form cusps. So, is this like the actual configuration of the...
This isn't stable. So the picture, you have a loop oscillating, and about once per period, there's a portion on the string that goes kind of loop like this.
So this is actually a picture of what the string configuration itself looks
like. Yeah, it's like a snapshot in time of the string going kind of loop.
Gotcha.
And the upshot is that sort of near the peak of this cusp, the two string segments come very close together, and they can annihilate with each other. And roughly, the amount of string that's annihilated isn't very big relative to the size of the loop. Roughly, the amount of string that's oscillated is roughly the geometrical mean of the string width with the loop size, L. And what happens is, because you have a small amount of annihilation, you produce particles. And it turns out that this cusp annihilation process seems to be the dominant source of particle creation from string loops. I'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so for an oscillating loop, the loop can lose energy to gravitational radiation. And the rate at which it loses energy is roughly g mu squared. And the string can also lose energy to particle creation by cusps. And the rate for this the power for this is just this expression. Now, the thing you'll see is that the rate at which the string loop loses energy to a cusp has a factor of the string width in it. And you'll recall that flat direction strings are very, very wide. And because these flat direction strings are so wide, the amount of particle creation in cusps is really, really enhanced. Again, the width of a flat direction string is set by the small mass scale M inverse, which is much, much bigger than the inverse symmetry breaking scale, which is the width of an ordinary string. So because of this, the particle creation signature from cosmic string loops is strongly enhanced. And in particular, if I look at very small loops, yes?
It's not immediately intuitively clear. If the object is very large, then the field gradients inside the object are not that big. And so the particle creation may even be smaller.
Yeah, well, I guess I guess we're going by energetics. As these bits of strings come together, the lowest energy configuration is for them to annihilate. So we expect this to be a fairly robust feature. But you're right, it is a very complicated nonlinear field configuration.
But just the whole energy goes into particles.
Yes, it's essentially.
It's not like a particle creation by the gradient of by the field strands.
No. It's really just annihilation of string segments. Okay, but in any case, if you look at this power, you compare it to that power, you can see that for very, very small loop sizes, the particle creation dominates. So this has some interesting implications for various string signatures. So one of the implications is that because the particle creation is enhanced, some of the gravitational wave signatures can be suppressed. Now, I should just mention quickly that even for ordinary strings, the typical initial loop size, the typical size of a loop when it's formed by this long string network, isn't very well understood. People aren't quite sure whether these loops are sort of horizon-sized or much, much smaller. So I'm going to talk about both small loops and big loops. But if the initial loop size is very small, it turns out that the gravitational wave signatures are very, very suppressed. Again, because the particle creation signature goes as 1 over the root of the length. So the smaller the length, the more particle creation you have. On the other hand, if I look at large initial loop sizes, initial loop sizes that are on the order of the horizon, I get a gravitational wave spectrum that looks like this. So roughly, this is the gravitational wave density per frequency bin. This is the frequency of the gravitational radiation. And these different lines correspond to different values of the symmetry breaking scale. And what happens in general is that at low frequencies correspond to larger loops. And these larger loops aren't very much affected by particle creation from cusping. On the other hand, if I look at higher frequencies, the higher frequencies correspond to smaller loops. And these smaller loops tend to decay more into particles through cusping than through gravity waves. So the upshot is that for ordinary strings, I'd have a flat spectrum going off to higher frequencies that are shown by these dotted lines. On the other hand, for my flat strings that have enhanced cusping, the gravity wave signatures are suppressed at higher frequencies. Again, because you're dumping more energy into particles than you are into gravity waves. Okay, so beyond suppressing gravitational wave signatures, you also get new particle creation signatures. So hopefully this will address your question about what the strings decay into. These particle creation string signatures are most important when your initial loop size is very small. So, well, let me just list a few. I don't have too much time. But one thing that you could get out of the decays of these string loops is dark matter. This shouldn't be too surprising. It depends on the theory. So we haven't specified a full theory, but we're talking about supersymmetry. So let's say it could be WIMPs. So let's say light is supersymmetric particle. But we don't specify the full theory, so we don't specify exactly what it is. But in principle, you can produce dark matter. And I don't have any number here because I don't have a model to specify. Another thing that that this particle creation can do is mess with the predictions of nucleosynthesis. So nucleosynthesis, people have used nuclear physics to predict the various light element abundances. And the predictions agree very well with what's observed. If you have string loops that are constantly decaying into particles, they're injecting energy into the universe as nucleosynthesis is going on. And as you inject energy, you can break up some of these light elements that are formed and change the abundances that are produced. Now, the fact that the observations seem to agree quite well with the predictions means that you get a bound on how much energy you can dump into the early universe at the time of nucleosynthesis. And what we find is roughly a limit on a flat direction g mu of about 10 to the minus 12. And this is assuming that all of the initial loop sizes are very small, so the particle creation dominates.
Usually the strong bound comes after the medium, right? Once the nuclear reactions are finished, then if on
yes,
top of
yeah,
this
right.
You have something, then you notice.
Yes.
But if this occurs during the medium, I don't think it
will happen. We do a sum from about 100 seconds on to about 10 to the 10. And done
by you, 100 seconds, you got to dump a lot of energy.
Well, yeah. I mean, the strongest bounds come later on. But yes. Another thing that can happen is that if you produce highly energetic photons at very late times, you can mess up the black body spectrum of the microwave background. So by comparing with the Vernet-Coby-Fares data, we can bound G mu to be less than about 10 to the minus 11. And particle creation can also generate cosmic rays. And for instance, looking at the diffuse gamma ray background seen by EGRIT, again, you can put a bound on particle creation. You can put a bound on this dimensionless G mu coupling of about 10 to the minus 11. And in general, these signatures are only really possible for flat strings, for which the particle creation is enhanced. And I should also mention just in passing that for these numbers, we assume that all the initial loop sizes are very small, so the particle creation is very, very enhanced. Okay.
Even though that is lost by the network rather than this whatever form of radiation you're talking about.
For these estimates.
Yes. And this so 100% could be so you have a 100% efficiency from loop link into radiation.
Yes, for these. So in general, since we don't really know the loop spectrum.
This is just conservative bound.
Yeah. We get weaker bounds if, let's say, you have a component in large strings and a component in small strings. But the small string length isn't crazy.
These are coming from the cusp or?
Yes, it's coming from loops forming cusps and producing particles.
So the emission is coming from the cusps.
Yes. Okay, so I'm just about out of time, so let me just summarize quickly. Cosmic strings from symmetry breaking along the supersymmetric flat direction are qualitatively different from ordinary strings. They're very wide, and their tension increases very slowly with the winding number. And these two properties give these strings essentially very different properties as signatures in the early universe. So for instance, you can produce higher winding modes dynamically through zippering. And zippering occurs in the early universe, and you end up with a multi-tension string network. The fact that these strings are very wide, it also enhances cusp annihilation. And this tends to suppress some of the gravitational wave signatures. And it also gives rise to new potential string signatures, such as dark matter, CMB distortions, cosmic rays, bounds of nucleus synthesis, and so on. So I'll wrap it up there. Thanks. Yes?
So you say that your strings are wide, right?
Yes.
So the work recently on the predominance of very small loops is premised on simulations that assume the zero width strings, like there's essentially many good degrees of. Whereas, I don't know if you know Bart Henrich's work on gauge theory strings, he also thinks that the particle production dominates, but it would not be cusp on loops.
Yes, no,
Particle production off of strings. So would everything that you say go through, instead of making loops, you directly produce, if you have string length going directly into particles straight off of long string?
Yes. Now, the small loops we have in mind are actually still very large compared to the width of the string. So the loop spectrum should still be fairly independent of the width. So the width of the string isn't big enough that, say, the recent Polchinski estimates of the loop spectrum will be changed. Those should go through in about the same way. But yes, there's this high Marsh picture where you just produce particles straight from cosmic strings. I was under the impression that had fallen out of favor a bit. But you're right. If you just produce particles directly from the strings, the signatures are actually very, very similar.
What is the scale of the length of the loops?
That's a good question. The answer is we don't really know. What's usually done is you write the initial loop size as some fraction of t. So t is roughly the size of the horizon. Now, the standard lore for a long time was that this coefficient alpha was the combination g mu. And recall, g mu is roughly the symmetry breaking scale over the Planck scale squared. Now, there have been some recent simulations that seem to point towards a population of much larger string loops, with alpha on the order of, say, 0.1. But there have also been new recent analytical studies that get much smaller values of alpha, that are g mu to some power of 1 plus something larger than 1. So these initial loop sizes are actually smaller
than molten core. But
what's an issue to the lead because
it's still very big. So so roughly you're comparing a Hubble scale to a microscopic quantities. So to tell you the truth, our little M scale, what we actually had in mind is that this little M would actually be related to supersymmetry breaking. So this little M would be something like 10 to the 3 GeV. Whereas today, the value of T is something like 10 to the 41 inverse GeV. So there's a big mass. So as far as the microscopic string size goes, at least these estimates seem to point towards loops that, even though we're calling them small, are still really big relative to the microscopic scale of the strings.
Other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in standard model, you can introduce an extra U1 by very naturally gauging D minus L, because this is an anomaly free combination. Are there any specific signatures of strings associated with the gauge group of D minus L?
I think some people have tried to use it for baryogenesis. I don't think I have much to say beyond that. But yes, I mean, depending on the precise nature of the gauge group, what you decay into will depend on that. So I think people have tried to use this for baryogenesis, but it's not very relevant.
Do you have these in the standard model, because you have a U1 symmetry in the scale?
No, you actually, well, it mixes with the SU2, and it's, you actually don't get other strings.
Okay, let's thank David again.